This is Audible.
McGraw-Hill Professional presents Toyota Kata, Managing People for Improvement, Adaptiveness, and Superior Results. Written by Mike Rother. Narrated by Todd Belcher. Forward. Mike Rother's Toyota Kata is a rare and exciting event. A book that casts entirely new light on a much-heralded set of management practices, giving those practices new significance and power. Countless people in the past 20 or more years have studied and written about Toyota's wildly successful management thinking and practice. But paradoxically, despite the vast amount of knowledge presented in these works, no organization outside Toyota's family of companies has ever come close to matching Toyota's stellar performance. There is a widespread feeling that something Toyota does is still not understood and put into practice by non-Toyota companies. Toyota Kata will change all that. In this book, Mike Rother penetrates Toyota's management methods to a depth never before reached. In doing so, he offers a set of new ideas and practices that enables any organization in any business to do what it takes to match Toyota's performance. This is not the first book in which Mike Rother presents path-breaking insights into Toyota. He advanced the business world's understanding of Toyota's methods light years in his 1998 book, Learning to See, co-authored with John Shook. A brief look at the message of Learning to See explains how Toyota Kata advances that understanding yet another order of magnitude. Learning to See describes and explains a mapping tool Toyota uses to see how work moves from the start of production to delivering finished product to the ultimate customer. Known inside Toyota as Material and Information Flow Mapping, Rother, Shook, and publisher Jim Womack renamed Toyota's tool Value Stream Mapping and explained it for the first time in their book. Thanks to the enormous success of Learning to See, Value Stream Mapping became one of the most widely used tools to teach and practice Toyota's vaunted production system. With the Value Stream Mapping tool, Rother and Shook show how to use many of Toyota's well-known techniques systematically to change a conventional batch-oriented mass production factory flow, replete with countless interruptions and massive delays, into a flow resembling what one finds in a typical Toyota factory. Familiar names for some of these techniques are Takt Time, Andon, Kanban, Heijunka, and Jidoka. For most students of Toyota, Learning to See was the first extensive and clear explanation into how to use Toyota's techniques to improve across an entire facility. That book, however, does not explore why and how these techniques evolved and continue to evolve at Toyota. Although Learning to See provides a monumental step forward in understanding how Toyota achieved the remarkable results it has enjoyed for over 50 years, it does not reveal why others, after implementing Toyota-style techniques, still seem unable to emulate Toyota's performance. How does Toyota develop its solutions? What specific process do they use? Now, in Toyota Kata, Managing People for Improvement, Adaptiveness, and Superior Results, Mike Rother shows us this next vital layer of Toyota practice. The central message of Toyota Kata is to describe and explain Toyota's process for managing people. Rother sets forth with great clarity and detail Toyota's unique improvement and leadership routines, or Kata, by which Toyota achieves sustained competitive advantage. The transformative insight in Toyota Kata is that Toyota's improvement Kata and coaching Kata both transcend the results-oriented level of thinking inherent in the management methods still used in most companies in the Western world. The findings in Toyota Kata confirm my own interpretation of what I observed so often in Toyota operations since my first study mission to Toyota's giant facility, TMMK, in Georgetown, Kentucky, in 1992. What distinguishes Toyota's practices from those observed in American and other Western companies is their focus on what I call managing by means, or MBM, rather than managing by results, or MBR. As far back as 1992, I learned from President Fujio Cho and members of his management team at Georgetown that Toyota steadfastly believes that organizational routines for improvement and adaptation, not quantitative financial targets, define the pathway to competitive advantage and long-term organizational survival. In this era, business organizations also have a great influence on the nature of society. How these organizations operate, and especially the ways of thinking and acting they teach their members, define not only the organization's success, but great swaths of our social fabric as well. While a rapid advance of knowledge about human behavior is now underway, those scientific findings are still too far removed from the day-to-day operation of our companies. Business organizations cannot yet access and use them to their benefit in practical ways. Because Toyota Kata is about developing new patterns of thinking and behavior in organizations, it provides a means for science to find application in our everyday lives. The potential is to reach new levels of performance in human endeavor by adopting more effective ways of working and of working together. In my opinion, the greatest change Mike Rother's Toyota Kata can bring to the non-Toyota business world is to replace traditional financial results-driven management thinking with an understanding that outstanding financial results and long-term organization survival follow best from continuous and robust process improvement and adaptation, not from driving people to achieve financial targets without regard for how their actions affect processes. What has prevented this change from happening before now is the lack of a clear and comprehensive explanation of how continuous improvement and adaptation occur in Toyota, the only company I know in the world that truly manages by means, not by results. That explanation is now available to anyone who studies Mike Rother's findings and message in Toyota Kata. H. Thomas Johnson, Portland, Oregon, Spring 2009. Introduction. Transforming our understanding of leadership and management. Imagine you have a way of managing that generates initiative among everyone in the organization to adapt, improve, and keep the organization moving forward. Imagine that although this method is different from how we currently manage, it is ultimately not difficult to understand. That is the subject of this book, which describes a way of bringing an organization to the top and keeping it there by influencing how everyone in it, yourself included, thinks, acts, and reacts. In many organizations, there is an unspoken frustration because of a gap between desired results and what really happens. Targets are set, but they are not reached. Change does not take place. The music industry's major labels, for example, were broadsided by digital music downloads, even though the widespread popularity of compiling homemade mix cassettes, starting over 30 years ago, indicated that the market was there. For several decades, Detroit's automakers chose not to focus on developing smaller, more efficient vehicles for their product portfolios, despite repeated signals since the 1970s that there was a growing market for them. More recently, PC industry giants were late to develop compact, internet-oriented laptops tailored for web surfing, email, sharing photos, downloading music, and watching videos, even though many people, sitting in plain view in coffee shops, use their laptop primarily for these tasks. Our reaction to the fate of the music industry, the automakers, the PC companies, and hundreds of organizations like them is predictable. We blame an organization's failure to adapt on poor decision-making by managers and leaders, and we may even call for those leaders to be replaced. Yet can there really be so many managers and leaders who themselves are the problem? Is that the root cause? I can assure you we are on the wrong path with from-the-hip assertions about bad managers and that hiring new ones, or more MBAs, is not going to solve this problem. So what is it that makes organizations fall behind and even totally miss the boat, and what can we do about it? What should we change, and to what should we change it? Once you know the answers to these questions, you will be even more capable of leading and managing people and of ensuring that your organization will find its way into the future. Most companies are led, managed, and populated by thoughtful, hard-working people who want their organization, their team, to succeed. The conclusion has become clear. it is not the people, but rather the prevailing management system within which we work that is a culprit. A problem lies in how we are managing our organizations, and there is a growing consensus that a new approach is needed, but we have not yet seen what that change should be. Business authors sometimes suggest that well-established, successful companies decline, while newer companies do well, because the new companies are not encumbered by an earlier, outmoded way of thinking. On the surface, that may seem true, but the important lesson actually lies one step deeper. The problem is not that a company's thinking is old, but that its thinking does not incorporate constant improvement and adaptation. Drawing on my research about Toyota, I offer you a means for managing people, for how leaders can conduct themselves, that is demonstrably superior to how we currently go about it. I am writing for anyone who is searching for a way to lead, manage, and develop people that produces improvement, adaptiveness, and superior results. You may be an experienced manager, executive, engineer, or perhaps you are just starting to learn about or practice management. Your organization may have only a few people, or it may have thousands. You are successful, but you want to be better and still relevant tomorrow. With that in mind, here is my definition of management: the systematic pursuit of desired conditions by utilizing human capabilities in a concerted way. Since we cannot know the future, it is impossible to say what sort of management systems we will be using then. However, precisely because we cannot see ahead, we can argue the following: that an effective management system will be one that keeps an organization adjusting to unpredictable, dynamic conditions and satisfying customers. Situations may always be different from place to place and time to time, so we cannot specify in advance what should be the content of people's actions. Leading people to implementing specific solutions such as assembly cells, Six Sigma tools, Kanban, diesel or hybrid powertrains, today's high-margin product, and so on, will not make an organization adaptive and continuously improving. Of greater interest is how people can sense and understand a situation and react to it in a way that moves the organization forward. One of the best examples we currently have of an adaptive, continuously improving company is Toyota. Of course, Toyota makes mistakes too, but so far no other company seems to improve and adapt every day in all processes, as systematically, effectively, and continuously. Few companies achieve so many ambitious objectives, usually on time and within budget. How does Toyota do it? We have known for a long time that Toyota does something that makes it more capable of continuously improving than other companies, and by now we have recognized that it lies in its management approach. But how Toyota manages from day to day and thereby embeds continuous improvement and adaptation into and across the organization has not yet been explained. That is about to change. In the ongoing effort to understand and describe what Toyota is doing, most books provide lists of the organization's practices or principles. The individual points may all be correct, yet making lists circumvents explaining how Toyota manages people, and as our now 20 years of unsuccessfully trying to emulate Toyota's success shows, such lists are not actionable. This is because an organization's collection of practices and principles at any point in time is an outcome that springs from its members' routines of thinking and behavior. Any organization's competitiveness, ability to adapt, and culture arise from the routines and habits by which the people in the organization conduct themselves every day. It is an issue of human behavior. The evidence of the last 20 years indicates that trying to copy or reproduce another company's tools, techniques, or principles does little to change an organization's culture, its way of doing things. For example, how do you get people to actually live principles? On the other hand, focusing on developing daily behavior patterns is a leverage point because, as the field of psychology shows us, with practice, behavior patterns are changeable, learnable, and reproducible. What has been missing, and the gap that Toyota Kata fills, is a look inside the engine room that is a clear explanation of daily behavior patterns at Toyota and how they are taught. By describing these underlying thinking and behavior routines, Toyota Kata establishes the context within which the Toyota practices previously observed and written about are developed and function. This gives us new power. This book describes two particular behavior routines, habits or patterns of thinking and conducting oneself, that are practiced over and over every day at Toyota. In Japan, such routines are called kata. These behavior patterns are not visible, are not described in Toyota documents, and it takes a long time to recognize them. Yet, they are how Toyota leads and manages its people. These two kata are taught to all Toyota employees and are a big part of what propels that company as an adaptive and continuously improving organization. If you want to understand Toyota and emulate its success, then these kata, more than the company's techniques or principles, are what you should be studying. Toward that end, they are presented here for you. Toyota's intention in using these kata is different enough from our management style that, from the perspective of our way of doing things, we do not immediately understand or see it. However, I think we are now close to a eureka, or light bulb, moment, a different way of viewing, interpreting, and understanding what Toyota is doing. Once we understand how Toyota uses the two kata described in this book, there can be a shift in our perception that will enable us to progress further, because once we recognize the underlying pattern in how something works, the subject becomes easier to grasp. The penny finally dropped, and now I understand it. The kata presented here cannot be explained in just one chapter, but the penny eventually drops, and once you get it, they are not so difficult to comprehend. This makes sense, too, since Toyota would like everyone in the organization to practice and utilize them. This book will help you get it. The new information that is presented here does not supplant what has already been written about Toyota, although it will require some adjustment in how we have thus far approached adopting lean manufacturing. The objective is that you will gain a much more useful understanding of how Toyota manages to achieve continuous improvement and adaptiveness, which will tell you a lot about Toyota as a whole, and a clearer view of what it will take to develop such behavior patterns in a non-Toyota organization. To do that, we'll tackle two overarching questions. Number one, what are the unseen managerial routines and thinking that lie behind Toyota's success with continuous improvement and adaptation? Number two, how can other companies develop similar routines and thinking in their organizations? This book presents behavior patterns at Toyota at a level where we are talking about psychology in organizations rather than just Toyota. Although the behavior routines presented here were discovered through research in production settings, they are universal and applicable in many different organizations, old or new, manufacturing or otherwise, from top to bottom. This is about a different and more effective way of managing people. How I learned. I've never been a Toyota employee, and I have not worked in a Toyota facility. In retrospect, this handicap turned out to be an advantage for two reasons. Number one, I had to figure things out myself by trying them, by experimenting, in real factory and managerial settings. Number two, after numerous iterations of experimentation, I began to notice patterns of thinking and behavior that are different from our prevailing managerial routines. These are the differences that Toyota insiders tend to overlook because they lack points of comparison, and that Toyota visitors, observers, benchmarkers, and interviewers will not see at the surface. Most of the findings in this book are based on hands-on experimentation and first-hand observation working with a great many organizations. This iterative, test-it-yourself approach takes a lot of time, but provides considerably deeper understanding and insight than can be gained through benchmarking or interviewing alone. The lessons here come from several years of applying certain technical and managerial Toyota practices in non-Toyota factory settings. This involved iterative trials, with particular attention paid to what did not work as intended, investigating why, adjusting accordingly, and trying again. This experimentation approach is referred to as Plan, Do, Check, Act, PDCA. Periodically visiting Toyota group sites and suppliers, and meeting with a variety of Toyota employees and former employees, in order to make observations and discuss recent findings. The work involved a regular interplay between these two aspects of the research, with one potentially influencing the direction of the other as I went back and forth between them. To facilitate and support this reciprocation, I maintain and regularly update a written document to reflect on what is being learned and what the next questions are. This document not only captures learning, it also ensures that communication is focused on facts and data as much as possible. You are essentially holding the current civilian version, as of this writing, of that document in your hands. This is how I have been distilling out fundamental but not immediately visible aspects of Toyota's approach, what is behind the curtain, so to speak. Note that Toyota does not utilize some of the terminology that is introduced here. To help us understand the way that Toyota people think and operate, I had to create some new terms. A Toyota employee may respond to a particular terminology with, "I don't know what that is," but they will work and behave as described here. The five parts of this book mirror how the research unfolded. Part 1 sets the challenge of long-term organizational survival. In Part 2, we use that lens to examine how we are currently managing our organizations. This is important as preparation, because to comprehend what is different about Toyota's thinking and behavior routines, we first have to understand our own. This then leads to the next question: how should people in an organization act so that it will thrive long-term? A big part of Toyota's answer to that question is what I call the improvement kata, which is examined in detail and is the heart of the book. The penny should drop for you in Part 3. But the improvement kata does not come to life in an organization simply because it is a good idea. The next logical question was, how does Toyota teach people improvement kata behavior? The answer is what I call Toyota's coaching kata, which is described in Part 4. Finally, after presenting these two Toyota kata, the question becomes, how do we develop improvement kata behavior in non-Toyota organizations? That is the subject of Part 5, how other companies can develop their own kata to suit their own organizations, and most of my current research. The research cycle never ends, of course, which means this book reflects a level of understanding at a point in time. There is more to learn, and there are undoubtedly some mistakes here. It is an interim report, as is any book, because nothing is the last word. A final comment. The way of thinking and acting described here has a potential beyond the business world. It shows us a scientifically systematic and constructive way of dealing with problems, uncertainty, and change. In other words, how we can work together and achieve beyond what we can see. The more I studied Toyota, the more I became intrigued by the broader possibility of such life lessons, and I invite you to think about them too as you go through this book. Mike Rother, Spring 2009, Ann Arbor, USA, Cologne, Germany. Part 1. The Situation. Chapter 1. What defines a company that thrives long-term? The applause dies down as the next conference speaker approaches the podium. The presentation is going to be about Toyota, and in his first slide, the speaker presents some impressive statistics that demonstrate Toyota's superior performance. The audience is nodding appreciatively. For about 2 decades now, this scene has been repeated countless times. So many books, articles, presentations, seminars, and workshops have begun with statistics about Toyota just like these. Toyota has shown sales growth for over 40 years, at the same time that U.S. automakers' sales reached a plateau or decreased. Toyota's profit exceeds that of other automakers. Toyota's market capitalization has for years exceeded that of GM, Ford, and Chrysler, and in recent years exceeded that of all three combined. In sales rank, Toyota has become the world leader and risen to the number 2 position in the United States. Of course, such statistics are interesting and useful in only one respect. They tell us that something different is happening at Toyota. The question then becomes, what is it? How have we been doing at answering that second question? Not so well, it seems. Books and articles about Toyota-style practices started appearing in the mid-1980s. Learning from such writings, manufacturers have certainly made many improvements in quality and productivity. There is no question that our factories are better than they were 20 years ago. But after 15 to 20 years of trying to copy Toyota, we are unable to find any company outside of the Toyota group of companies that has been able to keep adapting and improving its quality and cost competitiveness as systematically, as effectively, and as continuously as Toyota. That is an interesting statistic, too, and it represents a consensus among both Toyota insiders and Toyota observers. Looking back, we naturally put Toyota's visible tools in focus first. That is where we started, the door through which we enter the Toyota topic. It was a step in the learning process, which will also, of course, continue after this book. Since then, I went back to the research lab, several factories, to experiment further and present what I learned in this book. The visible elements, tools, techniques, and even the principles of Toyota's production system have been benchmarked and described many times in great detail, but just copying these visible elements does not seem to work. Why? What is missing? Let's go into it. We have been trying to copy the wrong things. What we have been doing is observing Toyota's current visible practices, classifying them into lists of elements and principles, and then trying to adopt them. This is reverse engineering, taking an object apart to see how it works in order to replicate it, and it is not working so well. Here are three reasons. Number one, critical aspects of Toyota are not visible. Toyota's tools and techniques, the things you see, are built upon invisible routines of thinking and acting, particularly in management, that differ significantly from those found in most companies. We have been trying to add Toyota production system practices and principles on top of our existing management thinking and practice without adjusting that thinking and practice. Toyota's techniques will not work properly, will not generate continuous improvement and adaptation without Toyota's underlying logic, which lies beyond our view. Interestingly, Toyota people themselves have had difficulty articulating and explaining to us their unique thinking and routines. In hindsight, this seems to be because these are the customary, pervasive way of operating there, and many Toyota people, who are traditionally promoted from within, have few points of comparison. For example, if I ask you what you did today, you would tell me many things, but you would probably not mention breathing. As a consequence, we cannot interview people at Toyota and expect to gain, from that alone, the deeper understanding we seek. Number two, reverse engineering does not make an organization adaptive and continuously improving. Toyota opens its factory doors to us again and again, but I imagine Toyota's leaders may also be shaking their heads and thinking, "Sure, come have a look, but why are you so interested in the solutions we develop for our specific problems? Why do you never study how we go about developing those solutions?" Since the future lies beyond what we can see, the solutions we employ today may not continue to be effective. The competitive advantage of an organization lies not so much in the solutions themselves, whether lean techniques, today's profitable product, or any other, but in the ability of the organization to understand conditions and create fitting, smart solutions. Focusing on solutions does not make an organization adaptive. For example, several years ago, a friend of mine visited a Toyota factory in Japan and observed that parts were presented to production line operators in flow racks. Wherever possible, the different part configurations for different vehicle types were all in the flow racks. This way, an operator could simply pick the appropriate part to fit the particular vehicle passing down the assembly line in front of him or her, which allows mixed model assembly without the necessity of changing parts in the racks. Many of us have been copying this idea for several years now. When my friend recently returned to the same factory, he found that many of the flow racks along that Toyota assembly line were gone and had been replaced with a different approach. Many of the parts for a vehicle are now put into a kit that travels along with the vehicle as it moves down the assembly line. When the vehicle is in an operator's workstation, the operator only sees those parts, and she always reaches to the same position to get the part. My friend was a little upset and asked his Toyota hosts, "So tell me, what is the right approach? Which is better, flow racks or kitting?" The Toyota hosts did not understand his question, and the response was, When you were in our factory a few years ago, we produced 4 different models on this assembly line. Today, we produce 8 different models on the same line, and keeping all those different part variations in the flow racks was no longer workable. Besides, we try to keep moving closer to a 1-by-1 flow. Whenever you visit us, you are simply looking at a solution we developed for a particular situation at a particular point in time. As we conducted benchmarking studies in the 1980s and 90s, and tried to explain the reasons for the manufacturing performance gap between Toyota and other automobile companies, we saw at Toyota the now familiar lean techniques, such as Kanban, cellular manufacturing, short changeovers, Andon lights, and so on. Many concluded, and I initially did too, that these new production techniques and the fact that Western industry was still relying on old techniques were the primary reasons for Toyota's superior performance. However, inferring that there has been a technological inflection point is a kind of benchmarking trap, which arises because benchmarking studies are done at a point in time. Our benchmarking did not scrutinize Toyota's admittedly less visible inner workings, nor the long and gradual slope of its productivity improvement over the prior decades. As a result, those studies did not establish cause and effect. The key point was not the new production techniques themselves, but rather that Toyota changes over time, that it develops new production techniques while many other manufacturers do not. As Michael Cusimano showed in his 1985 book, The Japanese Automobile Industry, Toyota's assembly plant productivity had already begun to inch ahead of U.S. vehicle assembly plant productivity as far back as the early 1960s, and it kept growing. Beyond benchmarking, a deeper look inside Toyota did not take place until Stephen Spear conducted research at Toyota for his Harvard Business School doctoral dissertation, which was published in 1999. It describes how Toyota's superior results spring more from routines of continuous improvement via experimentation than from the tools and practices that benchmarkers had seen. Spear pointed out that many of those tools and practices are, in fact, countermeasures developed out of Toyota's continuous improvement routines, which was one of the impulses for the research that led to this book. Number 3. Trying to reverse engineer puts us in an implementing mode. Implementing is a word we often use in a positive sense, but, believe it or not, having an implementation orientation actually impedes our organization's progress and the development of people's capabilities. We will not be successful in the Toyota style until we adopt more of a do-it-yourself problem-solving mode. Let me use an example to explain what I mean by an implementation versus a problem-solving mode. During a 3-day workshop at a factory in Germany, we spent the first 2 days learning about what Toyota is doing. On the 3rd day, we then turned our attention to the subject of how do we wish to proceed. During that part of the workshop, a participant raised her hand and spoke up. During the last 2 days, you painted a clear picture of what Toyota is doing. However, now that we are trying to figure out what we want to do, the way ahead is unclear. I am very dissatisfied with this. My response was, "That is exactly how it is supposed to be." But this answer did not make the workshop participant happy. There are perhaps only 3 things we can and need to know with certainty: where we are, where we want to be, and by what means we should maneuver the unclear territory between here and there. And the rest is supposed to be somewhat unclear, because we cannot see into the future. The way from where we are to where we want to be next is a gray zone full of unforeseeable obstacles, problems, and issues that we can only discover along the way. The best we can do is to know the approach, the means, we can utilize for dealing with the unclear path to a new desired condition, not what the content and steps of our actions, the solutions, will be. That is what I mean in this book when I say continuous improvement and adaptation, the ability to move toward a new desired state through an unclear and unpredictable territory by being sensitive to and responding to actual conditions on the ground. Like the workshop participant in Germany, humans have a tendency to want certainty and even to artificially create it based on beliefs when there is none. This is a point where we often get into trouble. If we believe the way ahead is set and clear, then we tend to blindly carry out a preconceived implementation plan rather than being sensitive to, learning from, and dealing adequately with what arises along the way. As a result, we do not reach the desired destination at all, despite our best intentions. If someone claims certainty about the steps that will be implemented to reach a desired destination, that should be a red flag to us. Uncertainty is normal. The path cannot be accurately predicted. And so how we deal with that is of paramount importance, and where we can derive our certainty and confidence. I can give you a preview of the rest of this book by pointing out that true certainty and confidence do not lie in preconceived implementation steps or solutions, which may or may not work as intended, but in understanding the logic and method for how to proceed through unclear territory. How do we get through that territory? By what means can we go beyond what we can see? What is management's role in this? What is the situation? As most of us know, the following describes the environment in which many of our organizations find themselves. Although they may seem steady state, conditions both outside and inside the organization are always changing. The process of evolution and change is always going on in your environment, whether you notice it or not. The shift may at times be so slow or subtle that your way of doing things does not show up as a problem until it is late. Try looking at it this way. If your working life was suddenly 100 years long instead of 35, would you still expect conditions to remain unchanged all the time? It is impossible for us to predict how those conditions will develop. Try as we might, humans do not have the capability to see the future. The future is fundamentally different than it appears through the prospectoscope. Daniel Gilbert, Stumbling on Happiness. If you fall behind your competitors, it is generally not possible to catch up quickly or in a few leaps. If there was something we could do or implement to get caught up again quickly, then our competitors will be doing that too. The implication is that if we want our organization to thrive for a long time, then how it interacts with conditions inside and outside the company is important. There is no finish line mentality. The objective is not to win, but to develop the capability of the organization to keep improving, adapting, and satisfying dynamic customer requirements. This capability for continuous incremental evolution and improvement represents perhaps the best assurance of durable competitive advantage and company survival. Why? Small incremental steps let us learn along the way, make adjustments, and discover the path to where we want to be. Since we cannot see very far ahead, we cannot rely on upfront planning alone. Improvement, adaptation, and even innovation result to a great extent from the accumulation of small steps. Each lesson learned helps us recognize the next step and adds to our knowledge and capability. Relying on technical innovation alone often provides only temporary competitive advantage. Technological innovations are important and offer competitive advantage, but they come infrequently and can often be copied by competitors. In many cases, we cannot expect to enjoy more than a brief technological advantage over competitors. Technological innovation is also arguably less the product of revolutionary breakthroughs by single individuals than the cumulative result of many incremental adaptations that have been pointed in a particular direction and conducted with special focus and energy. Cost and quality competitiveness tend to result from accumulation of many small steps over time. Again, if one could simply implement some measures to achieve cost and quality competitiveness, then every company would do it. Cost and quality improvements are actually made in small steps and take considerable time to achieve and accumulate. The results of continual cost reduction and quality improvement are therefore difficult to copy and thus offer a special competitive advantage. It is highly advantageous for a company in a competitive environment to combine efforts at innovation with unending continuous improvement of cost and quality competitiveness, even in the case of mature products. Relying on periodic improvements and innovations alone, only improving when we make a special effort or campaign, conceals a system that is static and vulnerable. Here is an interesting point to consider about your own organization. In many cases, the normal operating condition of an organization, its nature, is not improving. Many of us think of improvement as something that happens periodically, like a project or campaign. We make a special effort to improve or change when the need becomes urgent. But this is not how continuous improvement, adaptation, and sustained competitive advantage actually come about. Relying on periodic improvement or change efforts should be seen for what it is, only an occasional add-on to a system that by its nature tends to stand still. The president of a well-known company once told me, "We are continuously improving because in every one of our factories there is a Kaizen workshop occurring every week." When I asked how many processes there are in each of those factories, he said, 40 to 50. This means that each process gets focused improvement attention approximately once a year. That is not bad, and Toyota utilizes Kaizen workshops too, but it is not the same thing as continuous improvement. Many companies say, "We are continually improving," but mean that every week some process somewhere in the company is being improved in some way. We should be clear. Projects and workshops are not equal to continuous improvement. Let's agree on a definition of continuous improvement. It means that you are improving all processes every day. At Toyota, the improvement process occurs in every process, activity, and at every level of the company every day. And this improvement continues even if the numbers have already been met. Of course, from day-to-day improvement may involve small steps. We cannot leave a process alone and expect high quality, low cost, and stability. A popular concept is that we can utilize standards to maintain a process condition. However, it is generally not possible simply to maintain a level of process performance. A process will tend to erode no matter what, even if a standard is defined, explained to everyone, and posted. This is not because of poor discipline by workers, as many of us may believe, but due to interaction effects and entropy, which says that any organized process naturally tends to decline to a chaotic state if we leave it alone. I am indebted to Mr. Ralph Winkler for pointing out to me the second law of thermodynamics. Here is what happens. In every factory, small problems naturally occur every day in each production process. The test machine requires a retest. There is some machine downtime, bad parts, a sticky fixture, and so on. And the operators must find ways to deal with these problems and still make the required production quantity. The operators only have time to quickly fix or work around the problems, not to dig into, understand, and eliminate causes. Soon, extra inventory buffers, workarounds, and even extra people naturally creep into the process, which, although introduced with good intention, generates even more variables, fluctuation, and problems. In many factories, management has grown accustomed to this situation, and it has become the accepted mode of operating. Yet we accuse the operators of a lack of discipline. In fact, the operators are doing their best, and the problem lies in the system for which management is responsible. The point is that a process is either slipping back or being improved, and the best and perhaps only way to prevent slipping back is to keep trying to move forward, even if only in small steps. Furthermore, in competitive markets, treading water would mean falling behind if competitors are improving. Just sustaining, if it were possible, would in that case still equal slipping. According to W. Edwards Deming, 1980, quality of a product does not necessarily mean high quality. It means continual improvement of the process so that the consumer may depend on the uniformity of a product and purchase it at a low cost. Finding our way into the future. By what means can organizations be adaptive? While non-human species are subject to natural selection, that is, natural selection acts upon them, humans and human organizations have at least the potential to adapt consciously. All organizations are probably, to some degree, adaptive, but their improvement and adaptation are typically only periodic and conducted by specialists. In other words, such organizations are not by their nature adaptive. As a consequence, many organizations leave a considerable amount of inherent human potential untapped. How do we achieve adaptiveness? What do we need to focus on? Although we have tended to believe that production techniques like cellular manufacturing and Kanban, or some special principles, are the source of Toyota's competitive advantage. The most important factor that makes Toyota successful is the skill and actions of all the people in the organization. As I see it now, this is the primary differentiator between Toyota and other companies. It is an issue of human behavior. So now we arrive at the subject of managing people. Humans possess an astounding capability to learn, create, and solve problems. Toyota's ability to continuously improve and adapt lies in the actions and reactions of the people in the firm, in their ability to effectively understand situations and develop smart solutions. Toyota considers the improvement capability of all the people in an organization the strength of a company. From this perspective, then, it is better for an organization's adaptiveness, competitiveness, and survival to have a large group of people systematically, methodically, making many small steps of improvement every day, rather than a small group doing periodic big projects and events. Kathy Hanley, statement as a group leader at TMMK. Toyota has long considered its ability to permanently resolve problems and then improve stable processes as one of the company's competitive advantages. With an entire workforce charged with solving their workplace problems, the power of the intellectual capital of the company is tremendous. How can we utilize people's capabilities? Ideally, we would utilize the human intellect of everyone in the organization to move it beyond forces of natural selection and make it consciously adaptive. However, our human instincts and judgment are highly variable, subjective, and even irrational. If you ask 5 people, "What do we need to do here?" you will get 6 different answers. Furthermore, the environment is too dynamic, complex, and nonlinear for anyone to accurately predict more than just a short while ahead. How, then, can we utilize the capability of people for our organization's improvement and evolution if we cannot rely on human judgment? If an organization wants to thrive by continually improving and evolving, then it needs systematic procedures and routines, methods, that channel our human capabilities and achieve the potential. Such routines would guide and support everyone in the organization by giving them a specific pattern for how they should go about sensing, adapting, and improving. Toyota has a method, or means, to do exactly that. At Toyota, improvement and adaptation are systematic, and the method is a fundamental component of every task performed, not an add-on or a special initiative. Everyone at Toyota is taught to operate in this standard way, and it is applied to almost every situation. This goes well beyond just problem-solving techniques to encompass a firm-specific behavior routine. Developing and maintaining this behavior in the organization, then, is what defines the task of management. My definition of management: the systematic pursuit of desired conditions by utilizing human capabilities in a concerted way. Upon closer inspection, Toyota's way, as it is sometimes called, is characterized less by its tools or principles than by sets of procedural sequences, thinking, and behavior patterns that, when repeated over and over in daily work, lead to the desired outcome. These patterns are the context within which Toyota's tools and principles are developed and function. If there is one thing to look at in trying to understand and perhaps emulate Toyota's success, then these behavior patterns and how they are taught may well be it. Kata. In Japan, such patterns or routines are called kata, noun. The word stems from basic forms of movement in martial arts, which are handed down from master to student over generations. Some common translations or definitions are a way of doing something, a method or routine, a pattern, a standard form of movement, a predefined or a choreographed sequence of movements, the customary procedure, a training method or drill. Digging deeper, there is a further definition and translation for the word: a way of keeping 2 things in alignment or synchronization with one another. Eureka! This last definition is of particular interest with regard to the dynamic conditions that exist outside and inside a company. It suggests that, although conditions are always changing in unpredictable ways, an organization can have a method, a kata, for dealing with that. This is an interesting prospect. Such a method would connect the organization to current circumstances in the world, inside the organization, and in its work processes, and help it to stay in sync, in harmony, with those circumstances. A key concept underlying kata is that while we often cannot exercise much control over the realities around us, we can exercise control over, manage, how we deal with them. Kata are different from production techniques in that they pertain specifically to the behavior of people and are much more universally applicable. The kata described in this book are not limited to manufacturing or even to business organizations. Kata are also different from principles. The purpose of a principle is to help us make a choice, a decision, when we are confronted with options, like customer first or pull, don't push. However, a principle does not tell us how to do something, how to proceed, and what steps to take. That is what a kata does. Principles are developed out of repeated action, and concerted repeated action is what a kata guides you into. Toyota's kata are at a deeper level and precede principles. What, then, might be some attributes of a behavior form, a kata, that is utilized for continuous improvement and adaptation? The method would operate, in particular, at the process level. Whether in nature or in a human organization, improvement and adaptation seem to take place at the detail or process level. We can and need to think and plan on higher levels, like about eliminating hunger or developing a profitable small car, but the changes that ultimately lead to improvement or adaptation are often detail changes based on lessons learned in processes. If the objective is to improve in every process every day, then the kata would be embedded in and made inseparable from the daily work in those processes. The kata would become how we work through our day. Since humans do not possess the ability to predict what is coming, the method that generates improvement and adaptation would be content neutral, that is, it would be applicable in any situation. The method, the procedure, is prescribed, but the content is not. Since human judgment is not accurate or impartial, the method would, wherever possible, rely on facts rather than opinions or judgments. In other words, it would be depersonalized. The method for improvement would continue beyond the tenure of any one leader. Everyone in the organization would operate according to the method, regardless of who is in charge at the moment. In this book, we will examine in detail what are perhaps Toyota's two most fundamental kata. One I call the improvement kata, part 3, which is the repeating routine by which Toyota improves, adapts, and evolves. The improvement kata exactly fits the attributes spelled out above and provides a highly effective model for how people can work together, that is, how to manage an organization. The second I call the coaching kata, part 4, which is the repeating routine by which Toyota leaders and managers teach the improvement kata to everyone in the organization. The management challenge. Based on what I have been learning, the challenge we face is not to turn the heads of executives and managers toward implementing new production or management techniques or adopting new principles, but to achieving systematic continuous evolution and improvement across the organization by developing repeatedly and consistently applied behavioral routines, kata. Note that this challenge is significantly different than what we've been working on so far in our lean implementation efforts, and is primarily an issue of how we manage and lead people. Some adjustment in how we have been trying to adopt lean manufacturing will be necessary. Before we go on, I should mention that the idea of standardized behavioral routines often generates a prognosis that they will disable our creativity and limit our potential. What if, however, we can be even more creative, competitive, smart, out of the box, and successful precisely because we have a routine that does a better job of tapping and channeling our human capabilities? A difference lies in what we define as the routine. Notably, Toyota's improvement kata does not specify a content. It cannot, since that varies from time to time and situation to situation, but instead only the form that our thinking and behavior should take as we react to a situation. Humans derive a lot of their sense of security and confidence, what psychologist Albert Bandura calls self-efficacy, from predictable routines, from doing things the same way again and again. However, it's not possible for the content of what we do to stay the same, and if we try to artificially maintain it, it causes problems, because we are then adjusting to reality far too late and in a jerky manner. any organization whose members can face unpredictable and uncertain situations